We have been so lucky to have Patty Chang here with us, and I think she's just given us a wealth of knowledge. I appreciate her helping me out as I stumbled along doing the election, and she just did a great job. And, you know, I've known her in the past, but I never, of course, this is what happens when you have someone from the national office come. You get to know them so much better, and they're mentors all the way. So we're going to have, Patty is going to go ahead and address us. She has a banquet speech. We always, in the NFB, whenever we have a banquet, we always have a banquet speech. And when you go to national convention, as we talked about earlier, the banquet speech is given by the president of the National Federation of the Blind. And they're always very stirring and very action-focused. And so Patty's going to talk to us for a few minutes, and just enjoy your food, and we'll take it from there.
Let me begin by thanking you all for your attention and for the welcome that you've given to both Francisco and myself. My husband loves to travel, and we're very, very happy to be here. Before we did come to the convention, we were able to do an Anchorage City tour. So we had the joy of seeing some of your fine city. We did some outdoor touring. We saw moose, bald eagle, and got to the berry factory and the sausage and salmon place. Never seen so much chocolate in my life. Very interesting if you haven't been there before. Now, Bonnie asked me to give you a little bit of my story, which I'm happy to share with you and Will, but I also wanted to kind of talk to you about some things that have been on my mind in the last few years in regards to the Federation. So, many of you have been to Washington Seminar, and you know that when you go to Washington Seminar, John Perret, who's our executive director of advocacy and policy, speaks about the four P's. And whenever I hear him talk about the four P's, I think, you know, that's really a recipe for life, not just for what we do when we go to Washington Seminar. Now, some of you are sitting there and you're thinking, okay, I've been to Washington Seminar. Can I remember what the four P's are? And some of you are just thinking, what? So the four P's, slightly modified from what John says, are polite, patient, persuasive, and persistent. And I want you to think about how those play into your life as I tell you how they played into mine. So I grew up in a very rural community. And interestingly enough, coming to Alaska reminds me a lot of where I grew up. You get a little snowier faster, and you probably get a little colder in the middle of winter. But I was raised in a very small town in northern Michigan. And so I really did grow up at the end of a dirt road and lived in a trailer until I was five. My parents were very young parents. I got my Juris Doctorate before either of them got their JED. And the subject of names came up at dinner tonight, so I said I'd tell my story of how I got named. My real name is Patty Sue, as in Peggy Sue. Patty Sue. And no, you can't use it. It's a little bit too country for me. But I was named after a milk company that used to take our milk to market. We had a dairy farm at the time, and two things came up that led to my being named after this company. My mother used to carry these big milk jugs back and forth from the milk house on her belly. And then when they went to the hospital, I have a very, very big family. And so what they decided to do was think about what to name me. And my mother was quite appalled because everyone was thinking about names like Mildred and Hildred. And she looked out the window after giving birth, and one of the trucks from the same dairy, Patty Sue's dairy, was sitting behind the hospital delivering milk. So she said, get out, and my name became Patty Sue. Alaska really reminds me of Michigan because we came in a snowstorm, which is something that is very typical for Michigan. I didn't wear my heavyweight boots, but I was smart enough to wear boots to Alaska. And I grew up with a lot of the sports, the fishing, the hunting, the skiing, the snowboarding. We call it sledding. You may call it snowmobiling. But that's very common in northern Michigan. So I want to talk to you a little bit, and let's get back to those four P's for a minute. When I was born, my parents, and remember, they're very young. My mother is 17. When I was born, my parents were told that I was totally blind. And so my mother started going through what many parents do, which is a grieving process and trying to figure out what was really going on. But she kept seeing me respond to things that wouldn't normally have non-visual appeal. I would respond to colors. I would chase after things that didn't make noise. And so she persistently took me to doctors in Northern Michigan, and they, I think in part because of her youth and our poverty, basically blew her off and thought that she was suffering from a case of wishful thinking. So here's this 17-year-old mother who has to be very polite and patient and persistent. And finally, she persuades them that, yeah, I do have some vision. So I get to a town further south that has a little bit better medical facilities. And they decide that I am sighted, I'm blind in one eye, and I have normal vision, which I will retain in my left eye. So we proceed to educate me in the public schools. I, you know, started out as a sighted child. I just didn't have depth perception. And learned print, went to public school, didn't have any of the pre-kindergarten training that you might get, anything to deal with blindness. And then at the age of 12, I began to see halos around lights and have these massive headaches. I mean, just can't move your head headaches. So we started going to doctors again. And at that point, because they couldn't figure out what was wrong and my parents were getting a divorce, they decided it was all in my head. So many of you can recognize this. Sometimes the medical profession doesn't take you seriously if they can't figure it out. So I was a hypochondriac, despite having no history of being a hypochondriac. And again, we go back to polite, patient, persistent. And finally, I get a permission to go to University of Michigan Hospitals. This is about a year after I start having symptoms at the age of 12. And we see this old doctor, and I'll never forget the guy. His name was Dr. Henderson. And I was 12. I mean, I really swear he was 70, but maybe he was 40 because I was 12 and who knows. But he seemed real old to me. And he had this whole pack of residents and interns following him around. And they're doing all these tests and they can't figure out what's going on, but they figure that there's something going on. Because at this point, you can start seeing changes in my eyes. He decides to test me for glaucoma and the room went quiet. I mean, completely quiet. They all thought that he had lost his mind because children did not get glaucoma. There's actually a famous legal case about this. There's actually a famous legal malpractice case about this called Hilling. But they thought he was nuts. And at that time, to test for glaucoma, I'm dating myself, I'm almost 60. The only way that they could test at University of Michigan was to have you drink this green, I don't know how to describe it except slime. It was disgusting. And they told you before you drank it that if you didn't keep it down, you'd have to do it again. So I'm 13 at this time and really just, the stuff is awful on that. It's just horrible. And so I drank the goo and I kept it down. And lo and behold, they decided to have glaucoma. All right. So they figured it out so they can fix it, right? They can keep the vision that I've got at that point, which is 20/200 from my point of view today, quite sighted, because I'm now totally blind. But they tell my parents, oh, it'll be fine. Well, at this point, my mom has enough common sense to say, you all don't know what you're talking about. So she pushes, and I start getting cane training and Braille. I was lucky enough to get Braille at the age of 12, which my mother had to fight really hard to get. And I retained some residual vision to varying degrees from the age of 12 to 53. And at 53, I did become totally blind. So let me divert for a minute to talk about my education, because some of you will really relate to this. Started out, as I said, in public schools. But then at the age of 12, I'm still in public schools, but I'm confronting the fact that people, teachers, administrators now know that I am legally blind and probably losing vision. So the first thing that happens, and many of you can understand this, is my vision fluctuates a lot. So one day I can see you, she's got red on, she's way over there, and the next day I can't see you right in front of me. Another time I, you know, can see to read a book if the lighting's right, and not so much. So I had a number of teachers who thought I was faking. And I especially remember the social studies teacher. He used to call me to read every day because he was sure that my fluctuating vision meant that I was playing games with everybody. I did see him 40 years later, and I kind of tapped him with my cane, and I said, "Still think I'm faking, Mr. Flynn?" And so the other thing that I encountered that many of you have encountered is teachers not wanting you in their class. So I was prohibited from taking shop, which we all know could have been done. My mother fought like crazy to keep me in gym class because she wanted me to stay fit. And the gym teacher fought back by making me sit out every gym class I was in. So I spent a year in gym basically sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. But we persisted in my education, and I eventually finished high school and was admitted to all the colleges that I applied to. College was a whole lot better until I got to student teaching. My undergraduate degree is in a teacher of visually impaired. And I got to student teaching, and my advisor had trouble finding me a placement. Now, in retrospect, I don't think he tried too hard initially, but he wanted me to take a pass on it. And another case of the four Ps, I had to politely and patiently persuade him that that was not such a good idea. How was I going to get hired by anybody if they knew I didn't do student teaching? Why would you hire anybody? That made no sense to me at the time. And I'm going to divert here for a minute because I want you to think about how much we influence other people and don't realize it. Eventually, the teacher that took me as a student teacher took me because she didn't see the big deal. She had dated a guy in college way back when whose dad was blind. So I'll never know the man who influenced my life by helping me find a supervising teacher. And he influenced my life just by living his life because she had enough exposure to blindness that she didn't see the big deal. And after I went to student teach, I actually changed careers and ended up in law for 28 years. So I'm going to switch to employment for a minute. My first real job out of law school was, interestingly enough, with the City of Chicago Law Department. When I took it on, I'm pretty sure that they sort of thought, okay, University of Chicago, yay, great school. We don't expect much, but we want to get our ratings higher. Law firms and municipal law departments are rated based on where they draw students from. So if they hired me, top 10 law school, they didn't really care what I did. They just wanted their ratings to go up and they could fire me, you know, a year down the road or whatever. I ended up working for the city for 28 years. And by the time I left, I was an integral part of building and fire safety in the City of Chicago. I was supervising attorneys. I was serving on task forces. I was working with the mayor of the City of Chicago on building and fire codes. And I happened to look after I left at the law department roster. And at one time or another, before I left, I had supervised at least a third of a 300-person law department. So I'm hoping that I did what that dad did for someone else who comes down the road. I'm hoping that by supervising those people, they're more likely to hire a blind person. They're more likely to want to date a blind person, marry a blind person, to see us as human beings first, before you see blindness. And I think the most recent place that I've seen a real application of the four Ps, and remember what they are, polite, patient, persistent, persuasive, was after I became totally blind. I knew my blindness was coming. I knew from early on that I was going to, that vision was going to go, just a matter of when and where and so on. So I had learned to do most things non-visually, cooking, cleaning, childcare. But for some reason, it never crossed my mind that I needed to learn to keep a straight line without tracking lights visually, tracking the side of the sidewalk, whatever. So when I became totally blind, I went back to Blind Ink. And they trained me in travel. It's one thing the one thing that you'd think it would occur to you to do, right? Keeping a straight line is kind of an important thing, but I never did it. So I went to Blind Ink and got double travel lessons for weeks. Rob Hobson, who I knew from Illinois, great trainer, went out with me hours each day in Minnesota. And he politely and patiently, very persistently, persuaded me that I could travel on my own. And I want to turn finally to the place where I see the four Ps, I think, most of all. You know, when you look at what we do in the National Federation of the Blind, we know that we need to be polite and persistent and patient with outsiders. But I think sometimes we need to think hard about that. So we can look at all the things we've done. We didn't pass Marrakesh without being patient took more than 10 years. And we don't get legislation passed without being polite and persistent. And look at all the things we've done with Kellogg's. We're in our second round of relationships with Kellogg's. We did Rice Krispie Love Notes. That got millions of hits. We did the Kellogg's Navilins this summer. We're still partnering with some big organizations. And none of that happens overnight. And, you know, it's easy to understand that that has to happen with our outside relationships. But I think where we kind of lose track sometimes, and if you take nothing away from what I say tonight except this, I think sometimes we lose track of it within the National Federation of the Blind. So, for example, we say we want to meet people where they are. And what does that mean? Well, for me as president in Illinois, it often meant holding back, especially with people that I thought, quote unquote, should know better, you know, should know better. Ronza Othman is now president in Maryland. But when I met Ronza, she was a card carrying, I ain't carrying a cane gal, and she didn't need Braille. And I distinctly remember walking to the corner, waiting for her. Now, how many of you in the room have met Ronza? Okay, tell me this. If I had pushed Ronza, what do you think she'd have done? She'd have probably walked away. You can't, you know, she's a great example because since we met her where she was and let her see for herself what we quote unquote knew she needed, she is with us 100% today. And we need to remember to meet people where they are. And we need to remember to be polite and patient with each other. And yes, you want to be persistent. We have a consistent philosophy. And we make no secret of the fact that we want to persuade people that our philosophy is the right philosophy. But if we don't do that with love, hope, and determination, and we don't do it with kindness and politeness, we can turn people away. That's where we get people on the track that sometimes they think we're dogmatic. Well, if we're not careful, we can come off as dogmatic. We believe what we believe. And many of us know what we know, but we've got to understand where people are coming from and meet them where they are. And see this on your boards. And this is the speech I planned before I came here, so don't think I'm telling you anything about this weekend. But it's going to be crucial, especially with the changes that you have, to keep each other in mind when we think about being polite and patient, persistent, and persuasive. So I'm going to leave you with an ask for you to all reflect. How do the four P's play out in your life generally? And how can we really weave them into what we do together every single day? Because if we do this, if we weave the four P's into what we do together every day, we can truly turn dreams into reality and raise expectations. Thank you.